Hi, I'm Ray Debicki, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about comprehensive planning, and we have Ron Davis, guest contributor to the Urbanist. Ron also is a consultant for early-stage companies taking new tech to market. He's on the boards of FutureWise, Seattle Subway, and a few others. And of course, he's one of us irascible law school grads, but his diploma came from some little-known school in Boston. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the pod.
Hey, Ray. How are you doing?
I'm doing great because it means we're going to have some fun talking about the future of Seattle and whether or not it's going to be enough housing and trees to let us live here in 20 years.
Spoiler alert, it's not currently.
Stick around. So, Ron, do me a favor and introduce yourself a little bit.
Yeah, I live in Northeast Seattle in the Roosevelt area, previously the U District, with my wife and our two kids. Pretty active in kind of neighborhood activism around transit and housing and access for people and just quality of life. And then, kind of started to geek out years ago. Actually went down, took the Urbanist Red Pill about 8 years ago, I think. And by The Urbanist, I mean literally the website, The Urbanist, turned me from just a sort of general, generic national progressive to a local. I now understand that land use is how we provide or keep opportunity away from people, how we segregate people, how we control emissions. So I went down that rabbit hole and I've not been able to come out since.
We have a green masthead, but we really hide the fact that we do red pill a lot of people. So one of the groups that you work with is FutureWise. How did you get into working with some of them?
Yeah, FutureWise is a fantastic group. I think part of it, how did I get in, meet them initially? I think because of neighborhood of activism, like the Roosevelt Neighborhood Association, like the University YMCA, I just started to build up a little bit of people knew me because there's only, you know, as Ryan Watt says, 500 people that go to all the same meetings in Seattle. And so eventually got some introductions, and the stuff that they were interested in and working on was really compelling to me. And, you know, even though they're a top tier state level organization, they're of course always hungry for volunteers. So I don't know that, they said, here, can you fog a mirror? And they took me.
One of those interesting things about those organizations is you do show up and you get asked to volunteer a little bit and you keep going and going and volunteering more. It works out so well that way.
It does spin. I think the fact is I have a little more energy than a person should be born with. And so I do show up and get excited about stuff. And I think people get excited when you get excited. And so suddenly I was on the board.
Well, we are excited to talk to you about the comprehensive plan that's coming for the city of Seattle. It's a state requirement that all of the big cities around the state complete this comprehensive plan, and FutureWise is kind of at the head of a lot of that information. When we talk about comprehensive planning in the Urbanist articles, we kind of get into the weeds a little bit, and some of the folks outside of land use and building and city thinking don't necessarily get to catch on. When you talk to folks who are kind of outside of the Urbanist universe, how do you introduce comprehensive planning to them?
Yeah, so the comp plans are this kind of weird tail that wags the actual dog of things like zoning and everything else that we like to talk about. And so, but it's kind of behind the scenes. And so the way it works is our state law requires that cities and counties every 10 years build what's called a comprehensive plan. And those comp plans set the stage for how we're going to manage our growth. And they actually kind of tie us to the mast in a little bit of a way. And so they're also an opportunity for advocacy orgs who want to make sure cities are following through on their promises, get held accountable. And so it's a really big deal, and it's one of those things that flies below the radar. And so those of us out in geek land like to pay a lot of attention to it because we know that it's this big old lever and it's an opportunity to really shape the future. And then also it's just one of those rare moments in government where we're not moving from, putting out one fire after another, where we're actually thinking, hopefully clearly, about the future and preparing ourselves, because the pace at which government moves is slow and we need to be thinking in long time horizons.
I like the way you put it. It ties us to the mast about certain things. And one of the key term, of course, in a comprehensive plan is that it's comprehensive.
Yeah.
So we're looking at not just what kind of buildings we want to build, but also do we have safe beaches? Do we have enough water? Do we have electricity going everywhere? And so in that comprehensive look, tying to the mast is the correct idea, because really we're examining so many different parts of the city all at once and coming out with a theory of where the city's going to go, so that we can base a whole lot of other plans off of that.
That's exactly right. So you're starting all the way up at the, you know, the tippy tops of the tallest buildings, down to the street level and where the trees are at, and then all the way down into where the pipes are, right? Thinking about things like stormwater runoff. Mm-hmm. And all the above. So the way it works in Washington state is that the four county central Puget Sound region, Pierce, Snohomish, King, and Kitsap, all have a requirement this year to get going in their comp plan planning process. So other counties are on a slightly different schedule, a little bit behind us, and so we're all getting going, and so we're seeing this happen in Bellevue and Kirkland and Renton and everywhere else, but we're doing it here in Seattle, and of course our comp plan is particularly consequential because we're the biggest, baddest city around. And we sometimes set the stage for conversations regionally as well.
Well, that goes to it being the 2024 comprehensive plan, and we're 2 years out. It's going to take us 2 years to actually write this thing.
Yes. Yes, which is another one of those ways that it tends to attract geeks, because only a geek could care about something like this for 2 years at a time.
It really is the truth. Because when we get started and rolling in this, people really kind of grab onto the idea, hey, I'm ready for the future. I'm ready to talk about the future. And when am I actually going to see the document? And then we have to say, look, no, well, there's this first stage where the city's going to examine a whole lot of ideas. And the second stage where those ideas are going to come back. And we have to ask, did we do enough of those ideas? Is this the right way to do a comprehensive plan?
You know, it's really tough. I don't have a strong opinion on exactly how the process should go. I do think something that the city did well here, and I will have plenty to say about what I don't think they did well, but something I think the city did really well is they did, you know, they put out their draft environmental impact statement, which it doesn't matter why it's called that, but let's just say they put out this list of things they were thinking about doing, and they asked for public feedback, and they did work hard to work with community groups to get it out to people who might traditionally not want to geek out about such things, and I think got a fairly broad variety of comments, and they made the online engagement hub, I mean, I wouldn't say it was like perfectly easy to use, but from a user experience standpoint, compared to most City of Seattle website stuff I've done, actually, it was fairly functional. You could do upvotes, you could do downvotes, and it was very, at least, you know, 2010.
It wasn't the budget.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, you know, in that sense, yes, they're making it maybe more accessible than it's been in the past. And it is hard to make something that's so big and sprawling and complex accessible. So I appreciate that. But I do think, you know, in getting the offer we got, which is here are our five options, I felt a little bit like the toddler child of a parent who's trying to control the conversation and be like, you get to choose this or you get to choose that. And I was kind of looking at those choices feeling like, are you kidding me? Those are the choices, which is exactly what my toddlers did. That never worked with them, just to be clear.
It didn't work with my kids either, and they still don't fall for it when I say, this is the universe of things you get to pick from. They're like, I want option
Z. I've got a better universe. Yeah, exactly. So here we are, toddlers.
But yeah, right?
Yeah.
But that does bring us to where Seattle is right now with their comprehensive plan process. So, Ron, you had a guest piece in The Urbanist this week about how the city actually did with presenting some of their comprehensive plan issues. You didn't have the highest opinion past that initial thank you for letting us know phase. The actual things that the city came out with kind of left a little bit to be desired.
I mean, we're going through this series of crises right now that I think everybody is pretty on board with, right? We all know that we have a housing price crisis. We all know that we have a homelessness crisis. We all know that we're facing down a climate crisis. And we all know that they're related, or most of us do. And I think most people are indicating by the way they're voting, by what they're saying in polls, that we want our leaders to actually step up and do something about it. And we got kind of more of the same, you know, peanuts this time. And so to see us planning to fail so miserably, is really, really disappointing.
Ron Davis is with me today. He's on the FutureWise board and reminds us to join the Urbanist on Tuesday, December 12th for a talk with FutureWise about the coming legislative session in Olympia. Details for the event are at theurbanist.org/events. Ron, when we get into the discussion of the alternatives that the city has presented, they really came up with five things. Well, let's back up half a step. They came up with four things. The first thing is a kind of state mandated, we're not going to do any changes to how the city's going to grow.
Yeah, it's a way of establishing a baseline, right? So here, where are we now? And if we didn't do anything, what would happen?
And the number they came up with was the city doing nothing, the city would grow by 80,000 units over the next 20 years. And so that's about, what, 4,000 units a year?
Right. And I think we're building at around 8,000 units a year right now and not keeping up. So that doesn't seem like a good idea.
It definitely doesn't.
I mean, I know I was a law school guy, right? I wasn't a math major, but it just doesn't seem to add up.
Well, the rule is that if we could have done math, we'd all be doctors.
And that's why I married one. And she's very good at math.
So the first alternative is, of course, no action. And if no action means that all of the housing is going into these urban villages like Ballard and the University District and downtown, and then there's huge swaths of land that are remaining single-family detached houses. And with no change, we can expect 4,000 units a year, half of what we are getting now.
Right. And just like we've been for years, we're 10 to 20 years behind San Francisco, and we would just get more San Francisco-like. Right, we're just going to continue chasing them, and that would be what that plan would get us.
That's kind of a threat. I mean, the way San Francisco is going, completely unaffordable. They have a actually somewhat successful baseball team, but we really don't want to actually. You want to be able to live in the city in order to play with the, in order to have the good sports teams to view.
Yeah, at this point, you know, it seems like we're planning on people living in Marysville to come see the Mariners.
And so the alternative one seems to be a complete non-starter.
Yeah, and I mean, in defense of the city, you said this already, right? I think they're required in the process to say status quo is one option, and then to get down to what they're thinking in terms of change.
And so there are four more options that the city actually kind of developed. And I think the next three of them we can kind of clump together because all of them had kind of the same goal of adding about 20-25% more housing but in different ways. Alternative two was focused on the urban villages where there currently are a lot of houses going in. Second was broad. Alternative three was somewhat broad where you added more growth across the city.
Kind of a missing middle everywhere, sort of.
Maybe yeah.
Small scale missing middle, extra small scale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then option four was on corridors where we just put a whole bunch of apartments on smoke-filled, polluted boulevards.
Also kind of status quo-y.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you look at those three middle options, alternative two, three, and four, what do you take from that thinking?
Well, it's an overused metaphor. The deck chairs on the Titanic thing, but we're literally looking at creating a massive, massive housing deficit on top of the very significant housing deficit we have, but talking about where to do that. And so that just seems silly to me. The first one focuses on urban villages. Urban villages don't go away in any of these options, by the way. And the actual office that produced this plan is also the same office that about a year ago announced that urban villages perpetuate racist outcomes.
Of course
they do. And, and that they are unable and will always be unable to undo those racist outcomes. And we should not, you know, toy around with them anymore. So I'm not quite sure what happened between then and now, but here we are. I think the main thing to take away from the three is that they're all little steps, right? They're all kind of playing with the edges, and they all produce about 25% more homes. So instead of 80,000 homes over the course of 20 years, that's 100,000 homes, which is, you know, 6,000 and change a year. So I can do a little bit of math. but again, right now, at building at about 8,000, we're creating, we're continuing to deficit significantly. And so, that's a problem.
When we talk about urban villages and how these kind of either extend or keep concentrated on some of the urban villages, the urban village idea came up in the 90s. It was a way to focus resources on certain intersections and community hubs. And it just kind of got baked into Carbonite to that this is how this city is growing. And I keep looking. I'm in Ballard, of course, and just east of Ballard, they kind of released the floodgates east of 15th Avenue.
Yeah.
In order to put up some new housing. And you just see 1,000 new units pop up overnight. And it is so tumultuous for that neighborhood. But it's also needed because it's not happening anywhere else in town.
Right. If you squeeze all the parts of the balloon, the one part that's going to grow is going to grow way too fast, right? And the strong towns people talk about this a lot, which is that no neighborhood should be exempt from change, but you know, neighborhoods shouldn't be subject to absolute transformations overnight either. And because it is very jarring, right? Or it can be. I mean, some, you know, construction geeky people do enjoy that. But I think for the most part, that is upsetting to a lot of people. And so to try to focus in these tiny areas doesn't make sense. Look, there's something that was somewhat sensical about it in the sense of saying, hey, where is there a lot of jobs and opportunity and how do we sort of get people clustered into those places so that they have access to jobs and opportunity and transit? But to me, that's like Seattle, right? Like Seattle should be one of the region's urban villages, right? Or and really a lot more than Seattle even, right? And so I think while that sort of conceptually makes sense to put little dots inside the biggest city for essentially 1,000 miles in every direction and the biggest job center and biggest mm-hmm. economy is foolish, right? It's just absolutely blinkered.
It's almost fractal in a way that if you look at one map, Seattle's this big epicenter of jobs and houses and people, and then there's these little orbiting things around it. There's the concentrations in Bellevue. There's the concentrations in Olympia and Tacoma, but then you also take a step into Seattle and you see that there is the same kind of pattern of all of downtown being this main job center, and then these little clusters of a Ballard and a and going down Rainier and things like that. And then it's just a matter of which
how close you are.
How close you are.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always going to be some imbalance, just naturally some groups are going to really want to cluster close to downtown because downtown's where they work or something like that. Like you're not going to have perfectly evenly spread growth across a city, just probably if people are allowed to do what they want, right? They'll sort mm-hmm. of opt into a variety of things, but it's so artificially constrained right now. It's so locked out of so many places that we can't have moderate growth. It's hard to pull off, scalable midsize, whatever it is we want, because the only place we can build, you know, let's just try to get to 300 feet and 300 feet's fine. I'm not dissing that. I'm just saying, like, I think a lot of people go and travel to, you know, Brooklyn or Brookline in Boston and go, oh, this is gorgeous. And it's like, that's fairly dense housing, but it was allowed to grow up over time. And it wasn't the only place that could grow. And so you didn't just end up with gleaming towers.
So those three middle alternatives of focus growth and broad growth and corridor are really baked into this urban village concept. And it either extends it along corridors, it concentrates it in the urban villages, or it allows for a certain not quite urban village level of duplexes and things in the rest of the city.
Yes. And I should say, I said this thing about making the digging a bigger hole. So if we look at the last 20 years, the city's grown by about 30%. If we do that again over the course of 20 years, and that included some very slow growth years and some very fast growth years, if we do that again, we'll grow by about 220,000 people. At about a person and a half per new unit, and I don't know the exact number, that means we actually have per unit, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. It means we need 147,000 new houses just to keep things as overtight and overpriced as they are. And these
not
plans,
getting out of the ditch at all.
Oh gosh, no, yeah. But we need 147,000 just to tread water. And this is a plan for 100,000 units. So all three of these are plans for 100,000 units. So I guess Bellevue's gonna do it. I'm not sure.
Well, that's the fractal idea. Yeah, it's right. That hey, you get to kick it out to the next person
and someone else's backyard.
Yes.
Yes. That'll always work.
So that brings us through alternatives 2, 3, and 4. Now, there is a fifth alternative that the city has put out, which kind of layered all of these things on top of each other. They called it alternative 5 combined. Is that any better?
Yes, it is definitely better. I mean, it says we're going to put more housing in the urban villages. It says we're going to put more housing along the corridors. It says we're going to put more housing in the broad place, whatever that is, all the other places, a little more.
The ether.
The ether, yes, out there. And so it is better because it produces 50% more housing, and it only increases our housing deficit by 27,000 units. It's planning for things to get quite a bit worse, but maybe not, maybe not like Hong Kong prices, right? So, it's disappointing that that's the best they could come up with. I will say it's more ambitious than anything they've maybe done in the past, but I think it suggests a really significant gap between what is needed, what is understood to be needed by really any reasonably expert person you can meet, and what our bureaucracy is producing. And I don't know where the failure is, if it's staff related, if it's politician related, if it's fear. I don't know or pretend to diagnose it, but our leaders need to step up and do something about it.
So over the summer, the city released an initial concept of all 5 of these things. So between the no action, the focus broad corridor, alternatives 2, 3, and 4, and then the combined alternative 5, they came out and said, take a look at this. They put it on the website. And they got quite a few responses.
Yeah, it's really funny because when citizens provide feedback and the feedback is conservative, even if it's, 50 people show up to a meeting and say, we don't want a bike lane on 35th or something, the city tends to bow to that pressure very quickly. Here the city sought feedback and it got 1,000 comments and gave people a chance to vote on whether they liked those comments or not. And so just kind of pretty rich feedback. It's still not a poll of all 750,000 of us, but much richer than the usual who shows up to the meeting and yells. And the opinions of the city, or at least the people trying to represent the city and showing up, were really, really decisive. And they were really decisively somewhere along the line of like, are you effing kidding me? This is all you've got?
Right.
So we saw either people who didn't reject the premise but said, just give us option 5 or do option 5 and do some more than that. And then we had a set of people who just said, this whole range is foolish. And actually an option 6 campaign got going thanks to folks like Share the Cities and Tech for Housing. And this, of course, was circulated on The Urbanist. And in fact, I actually originally had a comment. My first comment was before the campaign got going, and mine said option 5++++ to say like your options suck. It was essentially the same thing as option 6, but right. Once 6 got going, I thought that was much smarter than mine. And so I went in and changed the title. But something like 40% of all the comments advocated for something beyond anything the city had offered. And something like close to around 2/3 to 70% of the comments said option 5 or something better. So you're talking about some of the most lopsided numbers you ever see in something like this.
When for some of the let's not do more proposals, the city offered an option to downvote and they got pretty ragged downvoted.
Not only did the really small proposals, we'll call them 1, 2, 3, and 4, not only did they not get a whole lot of positive comments, but yeah, when the votes were tallied, there were about 20,000 votes, and Share the Cities did this great analysis of sort of net votes, right? Total upvotes, total downvotes, because for some reason the city didn't report back on those. Share the Cities says that the total upvotes for essentially option 6 or some equivalent is plus 9,379 votes, and for the lowest options, it's minus 212.
That is kind of decisive.
And maybe that's why they didn't mention it, because they didn't seem to take it to heart.
So the city comes back then, and these options get turned up a little bit. Did they offer us an option 6?
No, they said, we hear you. You said you want us to go bigger, and so we're going to keep the same five options and maybe tinker with them a little bit.
That sounds quite city-ish in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's characteristic of a set of folks who aren't ready to have their paradigm changed, right? And unfortunately, that paradigm has gotten us into this hole. And I really do, if I had to guess, I believe that we have developed an allergy because people are afraid of kind of a set of neighborhood activists that have kind of sunsetted in a lot of their activism. And the truth is I think the city has given every indication, given the way we vote now, especially in even your elections when there's more of us showing up, given the way how we're being polled, given what we said here on the comp plan, we want the activist class, actually, as well as sort of everybody, is pretty much ready to actually look into the future rather than cling to the past. But I think, we've built a culture that says the most dangerous thing you can do is upset people in a way that is not conservative.
Right? So does that mean that Seattle's progressive reputation may actually get a progressive backbone?
I think we have a progressive electorate, or a fairly progressive electorate in the city, but I think it has not yet adequately manifested in a large swath of our public servants or our leaders. Now, I'm not actually sure, because I know a number of public servants, and pretty much all of them are progressives, and most of the ones I talk to feel like they're going to get slapped down if they try to do these things, and that they believe that the incentives in their agency, the career incentives, point toward, nobody ever got fired for doing more of the same thing. But I will get fired if I speak up.
So Ron Davis is joining me to talk comprehensive plan. I guess the question is, the city is not giving us an option six, an alternative six, in order to consider. Where do we start then? Where do we start for the next 2 years of building this comprehensive plan and representing that we would like Seattle to look different?
I mean, there are feedback sessions going on right now. And I think where the brain of our bureaucracy is right now, our best shot is to get a slightly better option five. But I think we have to not accept that. So first, my first concern is that in classic sort of Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis, they're going to go, look, we have this one option, we have two, three, and four, and we have five. We've got these two extremes. Let's pick option three, which is do basically nothing, except I think that was that broad. Anyway, yeah. Whatever the point is, some middling tepid milquetoast, and then we're all really screwed. And, you know, those of us who are not already tech millionaires could never buy our way into this place. It's already kind of that way. I think the citizen voice needs to be applied at pressure points is probably the best example. So we need to find those 1,000 people and get every single one of them writing to and calling their city council members, writing to and calling Bruce Harrell's office. Because in the end, the council can pressure, and we saw this from Teresa Mosqueda, who does get this, who's out there pushing for an option six. And I mean, she's functionally, I mean, she runs the budget committee. I think of her as kind of a de facto leader of the council in just how she manages conflict and hammers out legislative deals. And both she and Tammy Morales in the last week or two have spoken up in favor of something much more aggressive. So they're doing their part. But in the end, people love to blame the council for things, but they don't get to decide what their bureaucracy does. That's up to the mayor. And we have a mayor who said, we're not going to play small ball. That was his sort of the theme or a theme of his inaugural address. I heard him say it in a park near my house when he was campaigning. And this is his chance to say, I am not a continuation of a status quo that has made things messier and messier and put more and more people on the street and made this house, this housing in this city more and more out of reach for even the upper middle class. I think it's a chance for him to step up and say, no, I actually mean when I say I want to be ambitious. We'll see.
On the other side of the council members who are doing a good job, unfortunately, we still have some kind of conservative voices sitting on the council, kind of running a roadblock.
Kind of. Yes, that's one word for it. So, you know, we have a lot more ideological variety on our council than a lot of people appreciate. And on this particular topic, you know, Alex Peterson is the outlier. While we may have some timidity on parts of the council, Alex is way to the right of a Michael Bloomberg. He's way outside, really, the Democratic mainstream here. You've got the Biden administration talking about ending exclusionary zoning. You've certainly got more progressive folks like Elizabeth Warren's been talking about this for years. And Alex really seems to, I don't know if he just like wants to make Seattle a suburb again, or wants it to be the 1950s with lower taxes. But anyway, whatever the case is, I should say lower taxes for rich people. He proposed this classic, you know, only build it if it's affordable option. And as a certain friend of mine says, like, never trust someone when they say, I'm doing this for affordability, when we already know that that drives up the price of things.
It's the moral equivalent of the Simpsons character in the back yelling, what about the children?
Yeah, yes, right. I mean, it's like saying we should never build another car again unless it's a government subsidized car. And can you imagine what the price of all the non-subsidized cars would do, right? So as it turns out, this wasn't very popular, and I would dare say call it a bit of trolling from the actual bureaucrat's report. And I don't mean bureaucrat in a negative way, by the way. I think public servants are.
Oh,
I don't use it in a.
I spent years as a mid-level bureaucrat.
Yeah,
and I still say
bureaucrat. All right, we have law degrees. It's baked into our brains. So, but there was this mention in the report of, you know, hey, you know, Peterson did offer a different alternate, and there was no engagement about it, was basically the comment. And I thought, like, it was subtle, but I thought it was a bit of a dig. And I was like, oh, you know,
the
spicy for a public report.
The pastoral nature of Seattle will allow for the crickets that we hear when Councilmember Peterson offers a suggestion.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, I think a lot of folks don't realize how out of touch he is on all this stuff. But urbanist readers do, because you guys do a very regular job of reminding.
I think Doug Trum had a opinion piece about or commentary piece about Councilmember Peterson this week and his council members' desire to divert transit funding to pet projects. And
yeah, I think and the pet projects are always either, you know, light blue glitter on fire to make people feel safe and not do anything about actual public safety, or they're take money away from people on foot, disabled people on wheels, bikers on wheels, people in transit, and make it so that, you know, cars can drive 3 miles per hour faster.
So when the city came back with the kind of upgraded, extended alternatives, and I looked at them and saw alternative 5 kind of got a little more robust, but it looked like a cacophony to me. And so I think about what you said when this is edging towards this is going to be too much at this end, and this is going to be too little at this end. And so let's kind of artificially create a middle ground. The things that worry me about that middle ground are not necessarily that people will accept it, but it's more along the lines that people won't feel they have any opportunity to outsmart the experts in coming up with something better. So when we're talking about this comp plan, how technical do we have to be in order to say we want more?
It's a great question. I think we want more is probably all you have to be able to say. And so, you know, when it there are organizations like FutureWise that actually provide support, particularly for smaller municipalities that don't have a ton of, you know, internal technical expertise, that get way down deep in the weeds of comp planning. But the part where the city is supposed to be getting feedback from us is not about us knowing exactly, you know, what distance there should be between street trees on green streets, that whatever, right? It's about, does this look kind of like what you want? And I think our answer has to be something along the line of, you know, the math says this does not meet the challenge, the housing or climate challenges we face. The math suggests this will mean substantially more homelessness, and you've got to allow a lot more housing and fund a lot more social housing everywhere.
The hard part when you talk about increasing the amount of housing in so many places is that people say, oh my gosh, it's all going to look like some sort of anime towers and a whole lot of big city, 50-story blocks from the Soviet Union and things like that. And I think you were absolutely correct before when you said that some of the calmest lower districts of Brooklyn and Brookline, and my favorite is always in Montreal, where you have
Montreal's gorgeous,
three-story buildings, and it's the densest neighborhood in the continent. And it's just because there are opportunities for people to have multiple types of buildings in the same place.
You can go up to the top of Capitol Hill to get a little bit of sense of what this is like locally, where you have a mix of single family homes, sixplexes, eightplexes, 12plexes, and occasionally larger buildings in certain areas. And it's also one of our densest neighborhoods, right? You don't have to live in the land of steel and glass, but you do if you want to keep up and allow families like yours and mine to find their way into this city, to have the opportunities that we do, to hopefully reduce their carbon footprint because they aren't living in the exurbs. You do got to allow that, right? And it turns out there's some really cool benefits that come with it, because usually it can support really great transit. You can ditch the car most of the time, and the transit can be frequent enough that you actually get places and don't sit forever. It means really fantastic restaurants of all price levels. I mean, there's just a lot that comes quality of life-wise with it. And it's fair to say, yes, of course, there are some trade-offs, but most of the most beautiful cities, most of the places people love to take pictures of on vacation are full of mid-rise, cutesy, middle housing stuff.
A really important question. Do you think Seattle's base food, go-to cheap food options is still teriyaki, or have we moved to boba and poke?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I live in the U District, and I would say, my answer is going to lean toward the latter there. It's going to be boba and poke. And also, frankly, we're just getting, just in the U District, we have plenty of cheap eateries on the Ave that are just like, they're throwing bread at you in various forms, right? but we have some really, really excellent, particularly Chinese, Sichuan cuisine coming in. It's fantastic.
They're getting ready to open a shawarma place here in Ballard. And I'm really hopeful that we actually get the garlic sauce that of the U District.
Cedars. Yes. Unbelievable. Don't get near me after I've eaten it, though. My breath, I'm sure. Right? That's the one where if you're going to spend the evening with people, you got to make sure they eat it, too.
But that's really where it comes down to making a city that can support those kind of options. Like, we have really great neighborhoods with not towers going up, because the U District did get upzoned to a whole lot of 25, 30 story towers because it is A, one of the few neighborhoods that allows it, and B, has a transit stop we just spent $5 billion to build.
Yeah. And we're doing this up in Roosevelt too, which is more mid-rise. It's up to 7-8 stories. So like some pretty good sized buildings, but as a general rule, a lot of human scale. And we were just discussing at the Roosevelt Neighborhood Association meeting last night, the thing that people were the most excited about is three new restaurants that we all learned about, right? One of which is Vietnamese street food, which actually is maybe my favorite thing in the world. So I'm very excited about.
When we start thinking about the comprehensive plan, how do we do a better job connecting that type of outcome, the neighborhood walkability and good places to eat, to this kind of wonky, holy cow, we're talking about pipes in the ground and the height of buildings?
I think this is something that Share the Cities does a really nice job of. I think the Urbanist does a nice job of this. Sometimes we can all get a little too into the wonky weeds, but I think actually, you know who one of my favorite sort of Twitter stars on this is Queen Anne Greenways, right? Just tells beautiful stories. And I think it's about painting a picture of a city people want to live in and just getting them to show up in the little ways they need to sign a letter or write a note or send an email that says, hey, I want option 6. This is what I loved about that campaign. It became this shorthand for I want a livable, walkable, climate-friendly, inclusive city. And they didn't have to be, and I want X% to be social housing, like all the things that we nerds are doing. Because in the end, people don't care about that stuff, unless they're the weird group of people that do care about that stuff. They care about living in a safe, clean, fun place to be.
And that's it for this week's pod. We love to hear your thoughts. Send your comments, criticisms, and hopes for Alternative 6 in Seattle's comp plan to podcast@theurbanist.org. Thanks to Ron Davis for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Urbanist will be hosting an online meetup with FutureWise to talk about the legislative session coming up in 2023. The meetup will be on Tuesday, December 12th, and you can go to theurbanist.org/events to find out more. We look forward to you joining us next time for another podcast. I'm Ray Debicki. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk again soon.